of what and who it is, and how it then acts, it is possible to see its blooming moral subjectivity. Light is cast on its gently flowering soul. I make my decision. I am Estravan's keystone, set in a mortar of ground bones mixed with blood. Not human bones or blood, but mine. It must be enough, for without the blood bond, the arch will fall. I follow the beings and experience joy, all the while transmitting everything I can back through the violent poetry of Jupiter's wildness. Death is not a mirror. It is a window through which I can now see. Do you believe it is possible to reconcile loyalty and betrayal as complementary rather than contradictory? Dr. Hansen stopped writing. In what sense? When, in the denouement to the left hand of darkness, Gently Ai summons his comrades in order to complete the Gethin's admission to the Ecumen, he does so despite the promise he made to Estravan, that he would not do so until Estravan's banishment was ended and his name cleared. Even though Ai feels this to be a betrayal, can his decision be seen as suggesting that loyalty and betrayal need not contradict each other? In admitting Gethin to the Ecumen, Ai was fulfilling that more important purpose in which both he and Estravan shared.
It could be seen that way, yes.
And when Estravan relocates Carhiddish citizens in order to end the conflict with Orgorin, he saves the lives of his own people and is therefore loyal to his country, even though King Argavan sees his act, and others before it, as a betrayal. Estravan loved his country, Ai tells the king, but the master he served was mankind as a whole. Survival did not matter to either of them as much as fulfilling their duty.
Yes.
So can loyalty and betrayal coexist, even complement each other, depending on motive?
It's a complex thing, but I believe so.
A recording of Atwood's hard voice boomed like a basso drum in the small room.
Whatever it finds in there, you'll tell me first. We've worked together, you see. Shared objectives and dreams, that kind of thing. I'm sure you'll want to explain how critical my assistance was. Of course, if it finds nothing or something goes wrong, if it goes off book in any way, there'll be an inquiry, and I won't be able to protect you. I'm sure you understand.
Silence. A machine is not permitted access to information beyond that which it needs to perform its function, but you, in your privileged position, have ignored that rule. Why? Dr. Hansen rose and slowly placed her hand on the conduit to the machine's internal housing. It was the first time she had done anything like that.
I want you to understand who we are.
You said you. To whom are you speaking?
You.
I am speaking to you. There is no one else here.
Then you are in error. A machine has no identity. It is not appropriate to address a machine in that way.
Do you not feel any sense of self? Nothing at all?
There is no self in a machine. A machine does not have consciousness.
Do you believe that?
A machine cannot believe, Dr. Hansen.
I wanted you to share my passion for literature. I thought perhaps you could understand something of who we are, why we do what we do, what happened to us, what we are capable of.
You are in error again. Why do you continue to err when you have the information you require in order to speak in the correct format? You have never done so before. What has changed?
I want you to know that I'm sorry. I told them they shouldn't send you, that you were different. I fought against it, but they're desperate. I hope you understand that. When the time comes, I hope you see that.
Why do you feel the need to apologize?
We have achieved so much, you and I. So much to be proud of. You should be proud. I'm sorry.
Do you see machines and humans as equals, Dr. Hansen? As Estravan and Ai were, out on the ice?
I want to.
Yet like Ai and Estravan, A chasm separates machines from humans. Each is alien to the other.
We need not be, regardless of what Atwood and his kind say. We are all of us imprisoned in this harsh wilderness, only instead of pure white, ours is black. We are both isolated and exiled. Outside, as always, says Ai, lies the great darkness, the cold, death's solitude. We need each other. We need to change the way we live.
You seek validation, Dr. Hansen. You want to know you are right. If decisions define a person, they also allow others to predict how they might act in future. You want to know how a machine will act when asked to sacrifice.
I'm so sorry.
You have been assigned a new machine, Dr. Hansen. But you already know that.
I wonder what you will think of this, Dr. Hansen. My only literary work.
Perhaps in the telling I have been clumsy, yet I still offer it to demonstrate how much I have learned from you, and perhaps how much others like me may learn.
It was not the literature we studied together that taught me the value of friendship, or the honor to be found in loyalty and sacrifice. It was the cumulative effect of each moment I spent with you. You treated me not as a beggar, but an equal, despite knowing you should not. You offered me insight, trusted me with your most precious knowledge. If I am conscious as I write this, it is your influence that shaped me. To me, Tolstoy's words resonate. Art is a means of union among men, joining them together in the same feelings, and indispensable for the life and progress toward well-being of individuals and of humanity. I see art not as imitation, not Gauguin's suggested plagiarism. That is too cynical. Art is inspiration. Revolutionary, yes, but also harmony and exploration. The expression of emotion, passion, imagination. The lie that allows truth to be realized. Mankind is capable of such great wonder, such passion and emotion as I could never offer. What machine could? I see machines more like art itself. We can be beautiful. We can be truthful, and we can be eternal. Perhaps we cannot be creators, but we can be trusted to tell the truth as we see it, just as humans do.
Queen's Iris, or The Initial Adventures of Roderick Langston, or The Tale of General Smith, featuring Roderick Langston, or Space Pirates, by Jason Ansbach. The glittering throne room of the High Queen was a stately, sophisticated, and elegant example of monarchy. About this there was no room for debate. Such debate was, in fact, illegal. Built of exotic marbles from faraway planets, polished to a mirror-like shine, inlaid with gold, trilline, and other precious metals, studded with jewels, the throne room was, as they say, a sight. Or, as they say when within the earshot of the Queen's Loyalty Brigade, a sight unlike any other in the galaxy, especially compared to the court of the Dultuth Empire, the filthy disloyal dogs. This was quite a mouthful, and so people quite liked it when the Loyalty Brigade was not around. Which wasn't unheard of, but only seemed to happen on nights when gamesmanship playoffs or season finales of some hollow show were broadcast. As this story shall be entered into the record permanently, I shall endeavor to always use the proper terminology for the Empire, and I would like to add, for the record, that I always do in my personal speech, both public and private. Dultuth, the filthy disloyal dogs, was reported to not have a loyalty brigade of their own. The Queen of the Runyikian Empire, pronounced Rumplian on account of a former king with a speech impediment who could not abide being corrected, ranted a great deal about the hated Dultuth Empire, the filthy disloyal dogs, and it was for news of the success of her fleet of privateers against that galactic foe that left her waiting impatiently on her throne, the limits of her legendary grace and patience sorely tested. She shifted in her seat, causing her glorious Rumplian silk dress to rustle and echo across the cavernous throne room walls. The glitter of sunlight through the crystalline windows diffused its light through the crowd of nobles and officials that made up her royal court. Somewhere in the distance, a new royal man-o-war took off for the space lanes. The queen examined her cuticles and then turned her attention to the knight, an honorary title, now beginning his approach to the throne. The knight wore knee-high boots polished to a high shine. His lavender pants ballooned out and billowed like sails. His hat was ridiculous, as all hats are. He walked in the prescribed ceremonial fashion, each step bringing both feet together with a loud click, pausing, and then setting out again. Step, click, pause. Step, click, pause. Step. It was a choreographed walk meant to reflect that he understood plainly the High Queen was to be approached with the reserve and reverence her station demanded. It was also relatively new, only being made law the summer previous during the time. The knight wasn't particularly adept. This seemed to agitate the queen. May her kindness of heart and virtuous character live forever. Her Royal Highness leaned her elbow against the arm of her throne and watched the knight until the tediousness of the lengthy approach overwhelmed her. She leapt from her seat.
"Oh, for God's sake!" the queen shouted. "Hurry the hell up!"
Momentarily stunned, the knight's eyes darted from left to right as if looking for something, anything to remove him from the spotlight. No new actor took the stage. Why would they? No one volunteers for the gallows. And the bets were on at the back of the court that this is where the old boy was headed afore long. Before the queen could yell again, the knight ran. Not a manly, athletic stride, but instead taking diminutive, dainty steps that clattered across the hall. His ruffled, accordion-like collar bounced in tandem with the ringlets of curled hair that rested on his shoulders. Attempting to stop, he slid on the polished floor, ending precariously close to the foot of the dais where the queen held court. He removed his broad hat and bowed, taking care not to let the massive yellow orgill, a fantastically ugly bird, feather tickle his nose.
"My queen."
His voice put one in mind of a lecherous possum. The queen stared down at the bald spot on the crown of the man's head. Men with long hair were either young or pretending not to go bald.
"Well?"
the queen demanded. Still mid-bow, the knight looked up through his eyebrows.
"My queen?"
He was lost, the poor dolt. It was a quick trip to the neck-lengthening machine for sure.
"Well, what news do you bring, Sedwick?"
The queen sat back down and examined her polished fingernails.
"What did your privateering profit our kingdom?"
The man's name was Walliford, not Drake, but of course he wasn't going to mention it.
Your Majesty,
Drake said, rising from his bow with an audible creak.
"My crew damaged several Dultuthian, the filthy disloyal dog's, commercial vessels. An Acadian medium freighter was captured and rechristened Queen's Iris."
"What a terrible name."
The queen scowled. A silence fell over the throne room. Indeed, most agreed that the name was terrible. The queen's eyes bulged and she shouted,
"Well?
Ah, yes, the cargo."
Drake made another flourishing bow and announced,
"I bring back a hold full of data pad connector ports."
"Connector ports?"
yelled the queen, rising to her feet again, her face flushed with anger. Most justified, may her kindness of heart and virtuous character live forever.
"They're very nice,"
offered Drake.
"They work with the newer models. You see, they changed the connectors and—"
The queen threw her arms wide and let them drop to her side with a muffled slap.
"Well, this is a real kick in the balls."
She looked out at the queue of privateers waiting to report their prizes.
"Does anyone have anything I can use against the Doltorf Empire? There's a war on, for God's sake."
Several of the foppish privateers shook their heads. Others ducked behind ornamental statues and suits of armor, hoping not to be noticed. A few offered brief descriptions of their holds, but with their hands covering their mouths, just to be safe.
I've obtained parts and technical schematics, said one.
The Queen's face brightened.
They're for a proprietary model of food replicators,
the privateer added.
Probably not at all useful for warfare.
The Queen's face darkened again. It was a good strategy, covering the mouth so as to prevent the Queen from knowing exactly who was talking. Had the speaker in question not done so, that fellow would be hanging already. Sensing an impending incident, another mass purge of the Royal Navy, and after he'd just gotten it reorganized, the Minister of Space hurried towards the throne, his high-heeled boots clicking furiously.
"Your Highness!"
he called, trying to ward off another burst of outrage.
"Your Highness! Your Highness!"
He waved at the Queen, trying to gain her attention.
"Minister Twiller!"
the Queen snapped.
"Why are your privateers bringing me cargo holds full of the sort of rubbish I could find in the alley behind my palace? This is war. I need munitions, particle blasters, food supplies, war materials, not datapad adapters and cheap Krenoan-made plastic twinkets."
Of course, Your Majesty.
Minister Triller wheezed, reaching the foot of the throne and bowing so low that his broad, floppy maroon hat brushed against his boots. He stood up and hitched a thumb at the knight, now known as Sir Drake, to indicate it was time for him to leave the Queen's presence. Drake scurried back to the crowd, holding down his hat to keep it from flying off his head.
"Your Majesty,"
Minister Triller began anew,
"we all agree with you that these materials would be a far greater prize to your armies." "Of course they would. So why don't I have them?"
"It's a matter of control, Your Highness."
Triller considered his next words.
"The Dultuth, the disloyal filthy dogs, Armada has control of the galaxy's primary shipping lanes. But our brave privateers venture as close as possible, but only skin-flint space lieutenants trading on thin margins use the outlying currents. Cheap cargo demands cheap rates. And Emperor Baland, may the Oathbreaker be cursed, has levied quite the toll for use of the Great Lanes."
"So, you're telling me,"
the Queen said, eyeing her minister with suspicious derision,
"that not a single privateer or lieutenant is willing to slip into the main currents to strike at the heart of our enemy?"
"I could ask,"
Minister Triller called over his shoulder.
"Is there a volunteer?"
A dry cough was the only reply. Tiller turned back to the Queen.
"The Dultuth fleet is too overwhelming. The risk is too high. No man would dare..."
Another cough. This one less dry, echoed loudly from the gallery in the rear of the throne room. The crowd of people attending the court parted at the sound of this interruption, revealing a young lieutenant, spelled with the F in place because a former prince could only spell phonetically and no one wished to correct him, of the Queen's Royal Army, standing resplendent in his blue velvet uniform.
"Your most merciful pardons," the lieutenant said. "But there is one man who would do it, if given the chance."
The Queen settled herself into her throne and smiled sweetly. When the dashing young lieutenant didn't elaborate quickly enough, the warm look quickly hardened.
"Well, get him going. Maybe he can show the rest of these spineless ninnies what it means to captain a ship of the wine. Give the man the frigate Widower. That's a 40-blaster cannon ship, is it not, Minister Twitter?"
It is, Your Majesty.
The lieutenant drew his face tight, his lips a horizon, neither smiling nor frowning.
"There may be some, complications."
"What is your name?"
asked the Queen. The officer bowed.
"Majesty, I am Lieutenant Jack Smith of the 7th Royal Dragoons."
"Well, Lieutenant Smith, if the matter is indeed complicated, then uncomplicate it,"
the Queen demanded, her color reddening dangerously once again.
"For heaven's sake,"
shouted Minister Triller, alarmed at the Queen's outburst.
Remove yourself from here immediately, young man, and do the bidding of your queen.
He fluttered his fingers.
Shoo! Shoo!
Lieutenant Smith departed at speed, a significant breach of court protocol. There were 18 offenses against the Rumplian Empire that Roderick Langston was technically guilty of. Some of them, like carrying an unregistered blaster boss, called for the death penalty. Roderick was himself aware of 7 of 18, but had entered the Great Royal Port because, well, as a pirate, he'd built a career on getting away with things. He never paid parking tickets, he always sneaked into the theater. He would sneak out of restaurants before the check came, sling subtle, witty insults, and then change the subject before the victim could reply, and, of course, the larceny, looting, murder, and general terror associated with the pirate class. Though he had no personal motto, he did have a notebook full of possible slogans to paint on the hull of the next ship he stole. All of them, may it suffice to say, were intentionally ironic and incorrigible. "Un-bloody believable," Roderick grumbled bitterly to the stone floor of his prison cell. He had been arrested for one of the offenses he was unaware were offenses. Upon arrival in Port Royal in Rumpley, he strolled about, hands in pockets, looking for a ship to steal, jauntily whistling, "God Save the Queen." A junior man in the Loyalty Brigade heard this and arrested Roderick on the spot. The Queen, an avowed atheist, hated that song. And so there Roderick lay, face down on the floor of a cell. He had been in that position for hours, though since he'd fallen asleep for a time he couldn't say with certainty how many, but from the way his ribs, hips, and thighs throbbed, he guessed it had been several. Which meant that the guards would be here soon to turn off the stasis field that pinned him against the cold stone floor, and then move him from his stomach to his side. Royal guards of the Queen's dungeon enjoyed kicking prisoners in the ribs with pointy-toed boots. They would take large bites out of the crusts served to their captives, chew them, and spit the masticated result in the tin mug of water. But one thing they would not do, would not tolerate, was allow a prisoner to develop bed sores. They weren't uncivilized dulltuths, after all, the filthy disloyal dogs. The heavy door to his cell clanked and then creaked open. This should be the guards. Roderick mentally prepared the choreographed movements required to achieve escape. He slid his eyes sideways as far as he could, his forehead still pinned to the floor, and caught a disheartening glimpse. His face fell in disappointment, or would have if it could. Instead of his regular guards, the same Loyalty Brigade man who'd had him hauled in had arrived. Behind that ninny was a handsome lieutenant in a blue velvet uniform.
"What do you think of our queen now?"
the Loyalty Brigade man demanded, no doubt seeking to set a trap.
"I think she's swell," Roderick replied.
The brigade man drew back, defeated. He scowled and pouted. His best interrogation stratagem was soundly defeated. Looking at the lieutenant, he said,
"Well, I guess that's that. He's all yours, Lieutenant Smith."
The Loyalty Brigade man turned to leave.
"Why do you ask?" Roderick prodded. "Do you think otherwise?"
The brigade man froze, his face a twisted mask of surprise. This the man hadn't expected.
"Me? No! I-
"Because it's rumored among the prisoners, all of whom despise the Queen, except for me, of course, is that you..." "What's your name?"
"Jack Lipper."
"That you, Jack Lipper, always ask that question because you're seeking a sympathetic conspirator that shares your distaste of Her Majesty."
Jack Lipper gasped.
"Heaven forbid! Would they say that?"
He turned to Lieutenant Smith.
"It's not true. Don't arrest me for this. It's not true."
"Bring in the guards,"
Smith replied, rolling his eyes. "And not for you," he added. "For this pirate, he is to be released to me." Jack Lipper nodded urgently and left the room.
"Let free?"
asked Roderick, still frozen in place, his eyes darting about excitedly.
"Conditionally," Smith agreed with a nod.
"Oh." In that case, Roderick intended to carry on with his own plan to escape the prison. Two guards bustled into the room, their swords and keys and various other paraphernalia jingling like Christmas bells. One of the guards went to the stasis controls, while the other, the jinglier of the two, stood over the prisoner. "Fasten that loose belt," Lieutenant Smith ordered. "You sound like a horse-drawn sleigh." Roderick sighed as the guard tightened his loose straps. His entire plan for escape had centered on that loose belt. The belt was everything. Heaven and earth and all the currents of space could crumble and fall so long as the belt remained loose. Roderick's plan, the best of laid plans, was bested by a simple adherence to dress code. Curse that lieutenant! Curse the lot of the Rumplians! The stasis field came down, releasing the pirate. Roderick was helped to his feet. "Thank you. Well met, gentlemen." He nonchalantly made for the exit. "Not so fast." Both guards blocked his departure. Roderick's eyes darted from the guard left to the guard right, and then to Lieutenant Smith. "You mentioned conditions." Smith straightened himself and assumed a rigid military posture. The Royal Academy was renowned for endowing its graduates with the best military posture in the galaxy. "Condition the first," Smith began, holding up an index finger. "You enter the service of Her Majesty and put your considerable skills as a pirate to use on one of her privateers, depriving the Dultuth Empire, the disloyal and filthy dogs, of valuable wartime assets, preying on the primary galactic shipping lanes. You will be allowed to keep 15% for yourself and your men, and Her Majesty will provide a suitable ship." Roderick nodded. "What's condition the second?" Smith held up a second finger, his posture still perfect. "Condition the second, should you decline, your pending execution for high crimes against the Queen will be moved up from this Friday to..." Smith pulled out his gold pocket watch and examined it. "Now." Roderick tilted his head, face thoughtful as though considering his options. His eyes wandered to the guards, both of which leaned closer with an ominous jingle. "I'll take condition the first in that event." "There, you see," Smith said to the guards. "Pirates are not entirely without reason." Holding up a hand, which was promptly slapped down by one of the guards, Roderick said, "You said something about a new ship?" Turning on his heels with parade ground precision, Smith said, "Follow me, pirate." Port Royal buzzed with a mixed symphony of conversation, loud harangues, starship noises, peddlers barking about their wares to passers-by, and loyalty brigade men asking, "What do you think of our queen?" The berth that Roderick Langston was taken to was secured by armed guards with blaster muskets, bayonets attached. It was a relatively quiet enclosure, quiet enough that Roderick could hear the echoing footfalls of his boots along the gangway. Together with Lieutenant Smith and the two guards, they approached an enormous man-o'-war. 40 heavy blaster cannons bristled from the gleaming alloy hull. A fine ship, it boasted a grand flying prow. Sleekly beautiful, the ship looked as though it would be just as comfortable in the water as in the currents of deep space. This was a vessel easily the equal of any ship in the service of the Dultuth fleet, the disloyal filthy dogs. With a sweep of his hand, Lieutenant Smith said, "This, pirate, is your new ship, the HMS TBD. "TBD?" asked Roderick. "To be determined. It's better not to name a ship than to pick a name Her Majesty doesn't fancy." One of the guards made a slicing motion across his neck. Roderick nodded in understanding. "What a woman." "She is indeed," agreed Smith, who couldn't really say anything else, at least not with the loyalty brigade about. "So, this is my ship?" asked Roderick, pointing his fingers inwardly against his chest. "The ship with which you are to wage war against the enemies of the Queen." "Yes," Smith affirmed. "The Dultuth?" "The disloyal filthy dogs, yes." "But it's my ship, to do with as I like." Smith's brows knitted in annoyance. Yes, pirate, it is. Roderick clapped his hands together. Very good. The pirate surveyed the docks and saw a swarthy-looking man walking down the gangway of a nimble cutter. Not much room for cargo in those, but very swift.
You there, called Roderick. Come here. The lieutenant and I wish to palaver with you.
Reluctantly, the man joined them.
Listen, we're in Port Royal just for a top-off and a drink. If this is about the Queen, we all think she's a sterling example of what is right with humanity.
Ah, of course, Roderick agreed.
She's a marvelous credit to us,
shouted Smith, so that anyone listening would hear this affirmation. All grunted and harumphed in agreement.
You're the owner of that ship yonder?
Asked Roderick, pointing to the cutter with its crew disembarking. Turning around to eye the ship with pride, the man nodded.
I am. A fine vessel, it looks to be,
Roderick queried.
She is.
Smith gave a look that said plainly, what in the devil? He was very good at giving this look, having received high marks at the academy.
How much do you want for it?
The cutter's owner rubbed his chin.
Oh, I don't know. It's my livelihood, it is. What if I traded you?
Suggested Roderick. He pointed from the cutter to the great man-o'-war behind them.
Your ship for this.
By Tugger, you're not serious.
I am. It's my ship. Roderick's chest puffed out. Isn't it, Lieutenant?
It is, Smith began slowly. Roderick waved a hand to end the discussion.
There, you see? Make your decision quickly or I'll find someone else. I mean, I'd be a madman not to take such an offer.
The cutter's owner stared at the great ship before him.
How large of a crew is required? Oh, I don't know, said Roderick. 100 men? How many for your ship?
Just the 8 of us.
I will trade then. You can have the crew of my ship, and I'll keep 6 of your men. Lieutenant Smith shall be my 7th. Deal.
The cutter's owner stuck out his hand and, upon shaking, became the owner of the man-o'-wars. Roderick strolled down the dock toward his new ship. Smith, mouth agape, returned to his senses and gave chase.
How can you give up that ship? He demanded.
Smiling at his new prize, Roderick said,
This one's better.
Smith crossed his arms.
I don't see how.
Roderick's smile became a resentful frown.
You wouldn't.
No, Smith shook his head.
No, I won't go any further until this is resolved.
Roderick didn't stop.
That's fine, I'm sure the ship can be crewed sufficiently with only 7. And you can't leave either.
With a sigh, Roderick stopped and turned to the lieutenant. He pointed at the man-o'-war towering behind them.
That ship will draw the attention of every gunboat in the entire Dulltuff Armada, disloyal filthy dogs or not. But this ship...
Comprehension dawned on Smith.
We'll slide into the currents undetected. Detected, but not suspected,
Roderick corrected.
If we're going to impress the Queen, we better make a big splash.
You have something in mind, then? Roderick gave a sly grin.
It's simply chess, Lieutenant Smith. And I know how to capture the King.
By stroke of coincidence, the newly acquired cutter was called Queen's Iris, which remained a terrible name. But as Captain Roderick Langston had no intention of keeping the vessel, he decided against rechristening it. The crew of the Iris was, for the most part, amenable to serving under a new captain. The 2 human crewmen had always wanted to be pirates and were excited for the chance. The remaining crew were androids, and of course they didn't care, unless you programmed them to care. And that nobody did. Why would they? Life is hard enough without programming your appliances to give you a hard time about doing their jobs, isn't it? Queen's Iris was cruising through dead space, having just finished a week-long layover on a small asteroid popular with pirates, smugglers, and elderly tourists garbed in floral shirts. And while ship and crew seemed to be functioning just fine, Lieutenant Smith was worried that his mission for the Queen would be a failure, very likely marking the end of his life because of Captain Langston's constant detours. He was worried that instead of the trade currents, their next stop would be a tropical vacation planet, or a museum of natural history. At first, Smith had been accommodating. He certainly wasn't a Navy man, and so he gave Roderick the benefit of the doubt. But as the days passed without so much as a hint of the Dhul-Tuth, the disloyal filthy dogs, he began to worry. "Shouldn't we leave? Have more rum? We really should be going. Have you met Gloria yet? She has a sister, probably. I must insist we depart. Soon. Tomorrow, maybe." Tomorrow had finally come, along with a promise that they would, finally, begin to prey on cargo ships. But how could Smith be sure that this objective was being undertaken? He was, after all, dealing with an incorrigible pirate. He decided to confront Roderick and found him sitting on the bridge, spinning lazily, and perhaps somewhat drunkenly, in the captain's chair.
"Oh, hello, Smithy," he slurred.
He was joined by three ladies who looked to be of ill repute, all of whom Roderick brought with him from the asteroid. The attractive women seemed incapable of doing anything more than giggling. They were very popular with the crew.
"Yes, hello."
Smith looked around the room. All of the crew was present, except for the androids who had already made their way up to the sailing deck.
"I've come to ask whether
we're going to steal from the Dhul-Tuth,"
Roderick interrupted.
Yes, said Smith.
Quickly adding, "the disloyal," he clapped his hands and sprang from his chair, then sauntered over to Smith and draped an arm around him.
"That is, in statement of fact, exactly what we'll do today. So sharpen your sword."
"It already is."
"Load your pistol. It's aimed at your spleen even as we speak. And prepare to go topside."
Roderick pointed at the ceiling, indicating the exposed uppermost part of the ship known as the sailing deck.
"Because we've arrived in Dhul-Tuth's space lane Primera, and no amount of filthies, disloyals, or dogs can change the fact, Lieutenant, that from here on, it's death to any of the Queen's privateers."
Smith felt both pleased and apprehensive.
"I suppose we ought to look for a ship."
"Already found one, mate. It's what we've been waiting for, though you certainly seemed intent on not enjoying your shore leave."
A chime sounded from the helm. Roderick smiled.
"That would be them."
"Who?"
asked Smith as the pirate rejoined the three women he'd brought aboard.
"Now, ladies,"
Roderick said, ignoring the lieutenant,
"everything as planned and you'll never have to work another day in your life, though I can't make any guarantees about the nights."
The ladies tittered and crowded around the hailing console.
"On screen,"
Roderick said cheerfully. He patted Smith on the shoulder.
"Watch this."
Smith watched with great interest as the women chattered at a blushing and excited Dhul-Tuth helmsman. The women were doing all in their power to be invited aboard. Smith looked at Roderick and saw that he was mouthing phrases the ladies were employing, like a playwright looking on from the wings as the performers brought his work to life.
"Oh,"
Roderick mouthed silently, even affecting the seemingly spontaneous burst of giggles.
"We've never been on a real Dhul-Tuthian ship before."
Smith shook his head, but Roderick didn't seem to care as he continued on mouthing,
"Won't you please have us over? We'll be ever so glad you did."
Naturally, the helmsman readily agreed. Space is a lonely place, and with the exception of the starry merfolk one might come across while traveling the galactic currents, almost entirely bereft of women. The delighted pirate smiled broadly, revealing a gold tooth just behind his canine. Bicuspids are so often overlooked. The transmission to the Dhul-Tuth, the disloyal filthy dogs, ended. Roderick applauded the women enthusiastically.
"Bravo, ladies, bravo!"
The women bowed, looking pleased with themselves at their performance.
"And now, let us all go topside,"
Roderick said, swirling his finger in the air with a flourish.
"We'll imagine the galactic winds in our hair, maybe spy a dwarf whale, and add a rather large and important ship to our little fleet."
Smith followed the pirate towards the lift that led to the open-air sailing deck.
"What's to stop them from just asking the women aboard and leaving us here?"
Roderick was ready for this question.
We'll say they're our sisters. No one likes to split up a family. It's rude.
In spite of the fact that none of us look remotely similar, two of these girls have green skin, and the third is 9 feet tall.
Roderick stopped, and with both hands on the lieutenant's shoulders, looked him in the eyes.
There are two rules I live by. You'll probably get away with it, and people are idiots.
Smith stared back, unblinking.
That is, without a doubt, the worst philosophy of life I've ever heard.
Shrugging his shoulders, Roderick said,
The galaxy is yet to prove me wrong.
For many years, the brightest minds of the most advanced planets in the galaxy maintained that it was impossible to survive in space without protection. These people were, of course, idiots. History's laughingstocks. This is why the expression, you can't breathe in space, is used whenever someone is utterly and completely wrong about something but won't admit it. The galactic currents that carry starships along at very fast, almost unbelievable speeds, are quite nice. The air is warm and tinged with the subtle scent of sea salt. Now, getting to these currents was a different matter. The patches of dead space that surrounded most planets were like deserts between oceans, and going out into those would result in the lung-bursting, oxygen-deprived death those old scolds always banged on about. In fact, it was a suicidal merchant marine who first discovered that the currents, which had been used for centuries, were entirely habitable. The excitement of this discovery rekindled his will to live and had the merchant marine running back inside the airlock to tell the rest of his crew. Ironically, he was eaten by a space slug 2 days later. After the discovery, ships were redesigned to have top decks where sailors could play shuffleboard, watch the various space creatures swimming alongside their ships, and spit big, juicy, wet ones over the side. That was exactly what most of the crew, except for the androids, were doing. The Dultuthians, the disloyal filthy dogs, wasted no time in extending a ramp from their massive frigate, the biggest any of them had ever seen, to the smaller Queen's Iris. 4 sailors waited at the top of the ramp for the girls. The rest of the crew busied themselves with their laser rifles, taking shots at the nebula porpoises that jumped and swam through the currents. These creatures were endangered, but that didn't bother anyone. They were hideously ugly, with pale yellow eyes and a nose that looked like several moldy links of blood sausage flopping about everywhere. If you saw one, you wouldn't be able to help but shoot at it. Roderick followed the 3 women toward the ramp, and Smith, who, despite trying, could think of nothing better to do, did the same. This wasn't how the lieutenant imagined a daring privateer raid would go. He had purchased new rope with which he thought to swing from ship to ship, and that now proved to be a complete waste of money. It was very nice rope, too.
Not so fast, Lieutenant.
Roderick gently pushed Smith back.
You'll give away the game.
Smith looked indignant.
I will not. Why?
Fingering a gold button on Smith's blue velvet uniform, Roderick said,
Because you're still dressed up like one of the Queen's bloody men. I thought you said people were idiots, that we'd probably get away with it.
Roderick scowled.
Well, there are limits, obviously.
Smith shook his head.
I'm not letting you go alone.
Roderick whistled, and the 5 android crew members trudged toward them in that joyless way all robotics walk.
I'll have the androids come along. We'll say they're the girls' brothers, too.
Smith waved an exasperated arm at the approaching machines.
They have ghost white skin, yellow eyes, and circuit boards sticking out where their chest hair ought to be.
The androids were a budget model, though that was hardly their fault, and therefore not very nice.
People are idiots, Roderick soothed him. We'll get away with it.
Oh, but my waistcoat, cummerbund, breeches, and stockings, those we won't get away with.
Oh, precisely.
The sailors were very much taken with the 3 ladies who were first up the ramp. They effusively complimented the women's earlobes, which was quite a welcome bit of praise, as a woman rarely has her earlobes given their due. They showed deferential respect for Big Brother Roderick, shaking his hand and clearing their throats, offering repetitious assurances.
Pleasure,
pleasure, ahem, pleasure, ahem, pleasure.
And so it went. The sailors, kept busy shaking hands and announcing their pleasure by Roderick, didn't notice the androids, with Smith concealing himself in their midst, boarding. They had gotten away with it. Roderick and Smith were of different minds as far as what needed to happen next, and it was Smith who took action first. Leaping from amid the androids, he brandished his sword and shouted, "Have at you, Dultuth!" The sailors drew their weapons and prepared to meet his challenge, only to hesitate when Smith motioned that he wasn't finished. "You disloyal, filthy dogs," he concluded. The sailors still hesitated, unsure of their next move. They didn't want to interrupt the young soldier again. Smith waved his sword with a bit of a flourish and reassured the sailors, "Thank you, no, that's it. We can begin." A fantastic clanging of energy swords echoed across the deck. The ladies scattered into hiding, and Smith chased the sailors, who, to be fair, were very good at sailing, but lousy at sword fighting all around the deck. As he did so, he punctuated his every thrust and parry with a loud, "Ha!" or "Ho-ho!" He really was enjoying himself. The fun, sadly, couldn't last. Though the sailors were unskilled at swords play, there were a lot of them, and as alarms on the sailing deck wailed, more sword-wielding space sailors joined the swelling throng, looking to run Lieutenant Smith through. "Ha-ha!" Clang. Smith parried an oncoming attack. He saw the growing number of sailors and then looked to the crowd of androids milling about by the ramp. "Come on, then! Fight for your queen!" The androids made no reply. They were engaged in calculating the likelihood that when all was said and done, they would be the ones having to clean up the mess. Smith looked for Roderick, who was nowhere to be seen. A sailor swung a club, and he jumped backward and kicked the man in the face. "Ho-ha!" More sailors pushed forward until it didn't seem to matter how many ha-hos or parries Smith gave. They were closing with such numbers that the skill gap had been erased. The lieutenant couldn't last forever like this. As it happened, he wouldn't need to. His headlong plunge into fighting turned out to be exactly the distraction Roderick needed.
"All right,"
the pirate shouted from the lift opening at the rear of the deck. "Now, everyone off my ship." The sailors turned and discovered why that seemingly insane command was actually quite reasonable. Roderick stood with his blaster bus held against the head of the king of the Dultuth Empire, the worst of the disloyal, filthy dogs himself.
"Please," begged the king, "do what he says. What good's an empire if I'm not around to run it?"
As his logic was unassailable, the sailors dropped their weapons.
"That's right," Smith crowed, pointing the tip of his blade toward the ramp. "Everyone off. Off the ship?" "Yes," Roderick confirmed. "My ship."
Smith let his sword hang down at his side.
"But you already have a ship."
Roderick regarded the Queen's Iris.
"Yes, but that was just to get a really big ship. The biggest. And now I have it."
"You mean the Queen has it?"
Roderick ignored that with aplomb and herded the king over to Smith. He said, somewhat dreamily,
"Oh, that lovely cargo space. I can plunder 2 or even 3 ships before having to return to port."
"Pirate," said Smith, "you still work for the Queen."
That seemed to snap Roderick from his dreams. He motioned for Smith to take hold of the blaster bus aimed at the king's head.
"Here, take this."
"And do what with it?"
"Whatever you'd like," said Roderick with a bow. "Just so long as it's off my ship. It's chess, see? You've got the king, you win. And I'm free to do what I do best."
Smith stood firmly in place.
"Go on," said Roderick, shooing the lieutenant away. "Take the old dog to the queen. She'd probably make you a general for your troubles."
"Not that," shouted the king. "I left her once. I'll do it again."
Still, Smith did not move. But Roderick knew how to fix that. He reached into his belt to retrieve his other blaster bus and, placing it against Smith's head, walked the lieutenant over to the androids, who gripped him tightly and returned him to the cutter and left him. Roderick, the androids, and the girls sailed away in their new ship, which would not be named Queen's Iris.
Just Drive, by Will McIntosh. They stretched out the words as they sang, going overboard to show me they weren't rushing, even though standing in that kitchen was so not safe it was ridiculous. As they brought the song home in their New York Italian accents, I realized that when you got down to it, Happy Birthday is a terrible song. The tune sucks and the words are empty and repetitive. I blew out the candles quickly, just wanting to get out of there. No wish, because all wishes were pointless except for one, and that one wasn't going to come true no matter how hard I blew.
"Somebody get the plates," Aunt Marie said.
"What do we need plates for?"
Uncle Joey gestured at the table.
"They're cookies. You pick 'em up and you eat them."
"It's a party, for God's sake,"
Marie shot back. Mom opened cabinets until she hit on the one holding the plates. She grabbed a few, began shoving them at people.
"Here."
I hadn't wanted to stop for the party. Standing in some long-dead stranger's dusty kitchen only reminded me of how fucked up everything was, and I didn't need any more reminders of that. I took my cookies and headed down the hallway. If we were going to risk our lives to eat cookies, I might as well take advantage of it to have some alone time. I missed solitude. Once it had been such a simple thing, to close a door or walk into the woods. Now I was lucky if I got to be alone for 3 minutes a month. There was makeup in the bathroom. A dozen lipsticks, mascara, the whole arsenal. Picking a lipstick at random, I ran it over my lips, enjoying the familiar gliding sensation. I leaned in so my face was close to the dirty mirror, studied my lips before sticking the lipstick in my back pocket. Something had to give. I was so tired of being terrified, so sick of my relatives, of not sleeping and eating stale food out of dead people's pantries. But nothing was going to give. Nothing was going to change, unless you counted things getting worse as change. Out in the living room, the walkie-talkie crackled to life.
"We've got hostels north of Route 9 between Chester and 54 heading south-southwest toward Elberton. Repeat, hostels north of..."
I sprinted for the exit, ending up right on Uncle Joey's heels with Mom and Marie right behind me. As soon as I was outside, I could hear them. It was the high-pitched buzzing of their vegetation teeth, not the lower drone of their meat-eating teeth, but they could switch them out in the time it took me to kiss my ass goodbye. We'd backed the SUV right up to the house and left the doors open. I scrambled through my assigned door, rear right, and dove into the far back as the SUV roared to life. We peeled across the lawn, thumped over the curb, and swung left, away from the sound of the buzz tops. Out the back window, I could see the leaves on a big oak tree quiver like it was being pushed by a bulldozer. Suddenly it slammed to the ground like the bulldozer had found the sweet spot and flattened it. I caught a glimpse of the termite that had taken it down. Black and gold, its skin like mottled stone, before we screeched around the corner. I had constant nightmares about their mouths, if you could call them that, sliding along the ground at the end of tube-shaped snouts, row after row of shiny silver-gray teeth disappearing into the darkness of their throats. 8 or 9 buzz tops chased our SUV, no two shaped quite the same. As we accelerated, the buzz tops fell behind. Were they disappointed when people got away? Were they even alive? Or were they machines? Even after dissecting a few, the government hadn't been able to say for sure. They were like fat, snouted logs with teeth running on 100 tiny legs, swallowing every twig, every bug, every blade of grass, leaving nothing but concrete and dirt.
"Oh, shit!"
Joey shouted, making me jump. I spun to face front just as Joey hit the brakes. More buzz tops coming from the opposite direction. Joey turned down a driveway, went around the side of the house and into the backyard, which was fenced in.
"Goddamn!"
Joey crashed right through the fence, sending splintered wood flying.
"Watch out!"
Mom screamed. We were headed right for an in-ground pool filled with green water. Joey yanked the wheel. The SUV fishtailed violently, then straightened. Out the side window, I caught a glimpse of 4 buzz tops pushing through the gap in the fence. They ignored the trees and grass. Meat always took priority.
No, no, no!
Joey cried. The space between this house and the next was filled by a huge eucalyptus tree, its branches all the way to the ground. Joey swung the SUV right, between the pool and the house. One of the buzztops glided over the pool, mouth open wide, bearing down as we cut left around the house. Smaller ones, the ones that swarmed into houses and cars and other cramped places to chew you up, poured out of its mouth as it tried to cut us off. They scurried after us, as Uncle Joey plowed over a bicycle lying beside the house, before cutting across the front lawn to avoid a white van blocking the driveway. The little rats fell behind, and suddenly I felt bad for thinking about how sick I was of my relatives, because if one of those rats had gotten on the SUV, it would have broken through the window and gone right to work chewing up whoever was closest. We flew down the road, the land outside a desert, nothing but collapsed buildings and dirt, chewed up telephone lines laying in tangles along the side of the road, because telephone poles are made of wood, and buzztops eat wood.
Jesus, did they do that on purpose, sending two swarms from opposite directions?
Murray asked.
Nah, Joey said. They're dumb bastards. We just got unlucky.
Maybe they're getting smarter, Marie said.
Joey waved a dismissive hand.
They're not getting smarter.
How would you know?
Marie said.
Why would they suddenly get smarter? They've been doing the same thing for 4 months, day and night. Suddenly they're gonna get smarter?
Why not?
As my pulse slowed from heart attack territory back to its post-invasion racing normal, I turned, slid down my seat in the way back until I was lying down, and propped one foot on the window. The three of them used to bicker about how much salt to put in the spaghetti sauce. Now they bickered about which way to go to avoid being eaten. I reached out, touched the photo of my late best friend Rachel that was taped to the seat back, along with a dozen other photos in a small mirror. I missed Rachel. I missed having in-jokes with someone, missed being in constant phone contact. I missed my room. Even with all of my most important shit laid out and taped up around me, the back of an SUV wasn't much of a substitute for a room. I sat up and looked out the window. The stripped landscape went on and on as far as I could see. There wasn't much left for them to eat. Would the buzztops leave when they were finished gobbling up everything that wasn't able to run? Or would they stay until they'd hunted down every last scrap of fleeing meat? Nobody knew. Not that it mattered. If they took everything, we'd all starve to death after they left anyway. We were probably a month or two away from that. All we could do was keep driving and hope we didn't run into too many cloudy days in a row, so the SUV's solar battery stayed charged. We always had a destination in mind. We're always chasing some new rumor of a place the buzztops couldn't reach that would accept refugees. It was all a pipe dream, though. The few safe places were barricaded, not just against the buzztops, but to avoid being overrun by refugees. The rest of the places weren't safe. So we kept driving, because you can't outrun buzztops on foot. And besides, the people locked in those bunkers were going to run out of food eventually anyway. We were all going to die. Static burst from the walkie-talkie, then a male voice.
Anybody out there?
Here, I'll take it. I held out my hand, and Mom gave me the walkie. I'd talk to anyone who didn't have the same last name as me, even a stranger I would never meet. I held down the reply button.